You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. I'm your host, John Wildman. With me is my Bitch Talk teammate, Angela Tabora. And we're going to be talking about the Sundance film Softie. And we have three guests with us. And if each one of you could introduce yourselves to our audience.
My name is Boniface Mwangi. I'm from Kenya.
And I'm Jerry Mwangi. I'm also from Kenya.
I'm Sam Soko from Kenya, the director of Softie.
Okay, and Sam, we always let our filmmaker start us off by introducing our audience to the film. Tell us what Softie's about.
So Softie's about the lives of these incredible human beings that are with me right now, Boniface and Jerry and their family, and the story of Kenya. So it's a love story that about our country and the experiences that we have in our country, and the story about their love and their family and how the two kind of conflict with each other and asking the question of what comes first, country or family?
Right.
Yes.
I think we have to first give props because this is the first film from Kenya to ever premiere at Sundance. So it's about time.
Woo-hoo!
Hopefully this is the first of many. So congratulations on that front. And that's incredible. And for the story to be about this important family and this important moment in time.
Thank you so much.
So Sam, how did you connect with Boniface in the first place, and how did this film come about?
So we met, I think 7-8 years ago. And so we started, me and a couple of friends had started a company, a film company. And we were young, ambitious, trying to look for a space. And we always wanted to tell socially conscious stories. And Boniface had started a hub that cultivates and nurtures activists and creatives, a creative hub of sorts. So when we went there, and I think on the first day, Boniface was like, oh, I'm going for a protest. You guys should totally come.
And we were like, welcome. Yeah.
We were like, what the hell? I never went. Because who goes for a protest from someone you've just met?
This is Kenya.
And, you know, Kenya is special in so many ways. And, you know, and he really welcomed us, and he brought up back the footage from the protest, and that's how we started talking and engaging. And we had an idea of doing like a 5-minute activism manual based on his protests, which was super cool because he took live pics to Parliament to symbolize MP's greed. And you know, if you get to watch the film, you'll totally understand what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. He looks very calm right now, but
he's a calm man.
Yeah, no, and that's the thing. Like, you decided to do a documentary on this subject, mm-hmm. but you and your crew really have to be prepared for anything. And really, I mean, the bravery that it took just to follow in his footsteps.
No, but
actually, I have a backstory on that.
Yes,
the bravery is with him. Every time would get scared and you look at him, you're like, why the hell am I scared?
Yeah, he's standing in the front lines.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And not only him, even her, she's badass.
Yes.
In her own
oh
right.
We're getting to her. Yes.
So the bigger picture is not about actually the protest, it's about why we're doing it. We live in a country where you can get shot, killed for protesting, where there's no space for expressing yourself, where you can go to jail for just saying or demanding for your basic human rights. So beyond the film, actually, it's a struggle of young people in our country trying to make the country better. We don't want to live and look for visas in the US or go to other countries. They're saying, why don't we stay back home and fight for what you want to see in our country?
Absolutely, yeah. And I love how you portray the relationship between the two of you and how you go back and forth about is it country first or family first? But Boniface says, well, if I'm fighting for my country, doesn't that ultimately mean I'm fighting for my family? So Njeri, I wanted to speak with you about what were your thoughts when you found out there was going to be a film about your family and you're going to be portrayed in these intimate moments when you're really struggling?
Well, that's not how it started. The film was about him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for the longest time, he's always been in the front lines, and I was never in the front line. I thought he needs to come home where he's not an activist, where he comes home and just rests and enjoys his family and his children. So I was very deliberate in keeping a very low profile and a normal life as possible for him. That is not what is on social media, that is not what he has to do in terms of what people call him courageous for. So I found out much later that the story had come around to this side that I had been trying to keep very private and personal. And I remember telling Soko, you can't expose me like this. You cannot expose me like this, because I really want to lay low and keep a very low profile. And we're not, he's the public face. And we're a public family in that sense. But half the time people have never known whether he's married, and they get surprised that he is. They're even more surprised that he has not just one child, but three children. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy with people being surprised. I was happy with people being surprised about that. It was okay. It still is. I think they will not never know anymore that he is a family man with three children. And that's okay too.
There are big issues here that we're talking about. There are big causes. But there's also a relationship. And so as a filmmaker, you're balancing both. Mm-hmm. You're balancing the greater messages, you know, that Boniface wants to put out there, and the causes he's fighting for. Mm-hmm. And you're also creating this portrait, you know, of a family. Mm-hmm. So talk about one of the challenges of that. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, how you kind of work to interweave everything.
I think you kind of realize along the way that honesty plays such a key part in documentary filmmaking, especially with how you're treating the subject that you want to tell a story about and the characters that you're engaging with in telling those stories. With Bonnie and Jerry, even they know they're my friends separately. Yeah. Bonnie's my friend and I am honest and true to him, and Jerry's my friend and I'm honest and true to her. And I respect both of them in their own right and respect them in terms of where they're coming from. And in telling this story, is trying to understand where both of them are coming from. And that perhaps was probably the most difficult thing I've had to do in my life, is trying to have a harmony in their stories. And I totally respect where Boniface is coming from and the cause and what he's fighting for, because it's the same thing I believe in. We both come from a place of love for our country, mm-hmm. and what we want to see us change in our country. And it's where Jerry's coming from as well, because if she's really strong, like she's an activist in her own right. Mm-hmm. But I also understand where she comes from when she's talking about family and privacy and keeping in things that things that are important to her. So it's that question. It doesn't necessarily have to be about activism, or it's the same question that you have: if should I move to this city and stay here? Should I? How do I engage with my family? How do I engage with my work? It's a universal question. It's just that in this case and in this time that we are in, is we're in a moment where people have to kind of step out of a comfort zone, perhaps, and be like, stand up for what they believe in. But there are consequences to you standing up. So it's asking those questions and being like, should I say something? And if you don't, what does that mean? So it's trying to create that harmony, I think, in the storytelling.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about the first time that both of you saw this film. And, you know, Jerry had to go with the kids to the States for a while, and you were on your own. But sitting together and watching this film, did it help the relationship? Was it some sort of like, okay, I understand where you're coming from a little better? And how did that come about? How did you feel after that?
So when I watched the film about 3-4 weeks ago for the first time, and I think I was so shocked with what I saw. I saw how she lived in the U.S. because I wasn't there. I saw the struggle for the kids with an absentee father. And I heard her cry for me and what they were looking for. But she also saw the other side of me campaigning every single day and going home to an empty house. It make us stronger. I think now there's more empathy in a way, because I see where she's coming from and where I'm coming from. But I'm still processing. When I saw it for the first time, I told Soko, there's so many emotions. Because when you watch, there's a lot of things going on. So you watch 5 minutes of a particular scene, I remember like an entire week of what was going on during that particular time. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of reliving moments. I got shot, I got injured, I was in hospital, a lot of things. So it's all like reliving all those moments. So I'm still processing. I'm actually looking forward to seeing my kids watch it for the first time with us tonight, mm-hmm. and see how they're going to react. But I think it's an important story. It's a story that actually says what we're doing is important, and it's also very important for the world to hear and to see. And I hope that I'm still loved.
Bye. You know you are.
And Jerry, what was it like for you?
I think for me, it's there's a whole chunk of it that when we were away in the States, because I really struggled being away. It was necessary. It was choosing, do I remove my left eye or my right eye? Yeah, because do I leave my husband to campaign for the first time ever alone, go away with the children? Or do I take the children away to safety and let him focus on the campaign? It was very, very difficult for me. The whole time I was away, I kept wondering, did I do the right thing? And trying to convince myself that I would be asking myself the same question if I had stayed, because it was about our safety. So that was a real, real struggle. And I think for me, seeing the film, and I imagined a lot about what that was like for him, doing the campaign, but now seeing bits of it was, wow, it was overwhelming. It made me sad, like extremely sad, that I wasn't there with him to come home to a nice hot meal, to a nice warm bed. You know, it made me sad that he had to do all that alone. But I told him we won. It was not about the election itself, whether we got the vote. It was about the fact that we stood for something. And we made a lot of young people, not just in Kenya, but all over the world, to know that you can run a campaign, a clean campaign, and let people know that campaigns can be done differently, and that we can find the people we believe in and vote for them. And that, for me, was the win. Yeah.
And the film is a win. Again, the title of the film is Softy, screening the World Cinema Documentary Competition at Sundance. We've had our director, Sam Soko, and with our subjects, Boniface and Jerry, it's wonderful to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. I'm your host, John Wildman, and we have just a killer film. I saw it last night. The film is Dinner in America, and we've got the team here. So I'm going to ask each one of you to introduce yourselves, and let's start, Emily, with you.
Hi there, I'm Emily Skeggs.
I'm Adam Raymeyer.
I'm Kyle Gallner.
Pat Healy.
Leah Thompson.
Okay, and we always start this segment by letting our director introduce our audience to the film. So, tell us what the film is about.
Oh, boy. We always get this. And we've got a stock generic answer. You saw it last night, right?
I saw it last night.
Okay. So, wait. Emily's going to do it.
Oh, okay.
She remembers it. So,
I'm
going to pass the buck to the actor.
Here I go. Well, it's a renegade love story about two misfits who find each other and themselves through music.
Okay.
Speechless.
It's a really, really sexy love story, I think.
Ooh,
and a very satisfying.
Leah does it. Delivers.
Awesome.
It is a crazy time sexy love story.
Yeah.
And I want to go down the line with each one of our cast members that are here, because watching this is one of those films that I have to think that when you guys got the script, you're going, I cannot wait. I'm going to dig into this. I'm going to have the greatest time with this. And it shows in the performances. And, of course, Emily and Kyle, we're going to talk about your twosome. So actually, I'm going to start on this case with Pat and Leah, because we've seen you, both of you, in a lot of stuff, and seen both of you really deliver in a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I have to think this was just fun time. So, Leah, talk about what you did.
I just love this script, and I just wanted to be part of it. Adam's vision is so incredible, and so they asked me to do it. And I have been a fan of Kyle's for a long time, so the opportunity to just, like, create mayhem and make out with him was Dear Diary, hashtag good time. But it was, I have a soft spot in my heart for independent films that have someone at the helm, that it's their vision, it's not watered down, and I love supporting that, and I had a great time, and the movie turned out, I mean, the script was brilliant, and the movie's double brilliant, so that's a joy, and I think everyone was there to play with Adam. He inspired us, and we were there to go as far as he needed us to go.
Mm-hmm. And Pat, same thing with you. I mean, again, whether it be genre films or, you know, or other stuff, you know, you always come up with great things. And here again, we've got another wonderful Pat Healy performance.
Oh,
so
thanks.
Talk about what you did.
Well, I always, I just thought of this now. I keep coming up with new stuff today, but how this movie's about how, you know, sort of weirdos find each other. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing in the film business. Like, you know, Adam and I were just talking about a mutual friend, director friend of ours, and they find me because I do strange and interesting things often, and a lot of the times it's like, you know, I'm three pages in and I'm you know, sleeping in bed with my grandma's corpse or something. And I'm like, hey man, I'm not that dark. Like, thank you, but you know, I'm flattered, but no thank you. So you get something like this that is like, oh, this guy, he gets that. And I, you know, we share obviously sensibility, and he likes me apparently because he's offering it to me. So it was just really funny and fun. And you know, I've always loved these kinds of movies. I've been drawn to kind of cult movies since I was, I guess, a preteen. There's a book called Cult Movies by Danny Peary that just, I ended up seeking out all of these famous cult movies, you know, and some Repo Man is one of them, and Eraserhead, you know, things like that. Yeah. And this just felt like it was in that wheelhouse, but I just thought it was really funny and fun. And we really only met, I guess we spoke on the phone, but we met when I came there. And sometimes when you read something like this that's this wild and off the wall, there's some like obnoxious kid, you know, and he makes a good movie, but like, you know, they see this like he's like a real man and a real artist and you know, a compatriot and you know, a fellow traveler. So I was like, okay, cool, this guy knows what he's doing. And these two, Emily and Kyle, are amazing. So that was, I didn't know either of them before this, so I'm so happy that I do now. That was pretty inspiring to work with them, but to watch that last night was the greatest joy for me of it.
And it sounds weird to say in a film as crazy as this that it's anchored by two performances, but it really is, Kyle and Emily. I mean, the two of you, the interplay between the two of you has such wonderful detail, which makes everything fly. And whether it be the interactions in with the other characters offshoot, or whether it be just the payoffs that we get. So, you know, and we're gonna talk about Adam's process, cracking the whip on everybody in a moment. But I want to talk to the two of you and have both of you talk about working together, and you know, and how you kind of worked, you know, got that trust between each other to pull that stuff off.
Well, I mean, I think that goes into Adam's process. He got us out there like 2 weeks early, and we had to record all the music, and you know, they have a story about how I'll let Skeggs tell the story how they wrote the song and stuff, but you know, we sat down and me and Emily like hung out every day. We talked about stuff, we would cook each other dinner, we pretty much spent like every minute we could together until we got to set. And by the time we got there and spending all the time with Adam and talking about the film together, we were really ready to go, that it was kind of like all bets were off. There was a trust there that I've never really experienced with another actor, where it was, we knew what we were going to do going in, but it was like, well, push it further. Mm-hmm. And I really, you know, attribute that to Adam and Emily, to be able to open up and not be afraid to try, because these characters are like really off the wall, that if you hold back at all, it doesn't really work. You kind of have to be able to go at like 11 the whole time. And you know, Skeggs allowed me to do that, and Adam allowed me to do that, and honestly everybody there was game. If anybody wasn't game for this movie, this thing would not have worked.
Go to like crazy places with it, unless like the best thing a director can do about many things is just make you feel safe right away, and then you're just like, I'll do anything for you, you know.
Right.
Totally. Let's talk about the songs.
Oh, the songs.
Yes.
So we, in the first 2 weeks that we had together in rehearsal, Adam and I got together, and Adam had actually, we remember this today, Adam had sent us, before we even got to Detroit, these playlists. Beautiful playlists. It was like mixtape style, side A, side B of Patty, and side A, side B of Simon. So we had already such a beautiful wealth of material to pull from. But Adam had asked that I write some sort of stream of consciousness Patty poetry and character before we got there. And so it was like the first or second day, we holed up in a room together, sort of like they do in the movie, mm-hmm. and wrote the song together, mm-hmm. Sort of cherry picking through what I had written, and Adam laying down the bass line and figuring out the guitar.
We did it just like they do in the movie. It was the same exact process. And my background's in four-track recording and home recording, and I'm big into that. I always have been. And the style that Simon and Patty record in the movie is right out of my playbook. I do them fast and furious, stream of conscious, just boom, 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 boom. And I don't think too much about it. I'm not saying they're all as great as the one. It was, you have somebody that can like sing like really well, like Emily. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, she can go beyond what she did in the film, but what's so beautiful about, you know, I mean, I'm talking about like, you know, range and stuff like that, but what she did in the film is like, it's pulled back to a place that's believable, and then it's just this pure, you know, expression, and that's, it's just so profound, that moment for me.
Well, now, and I also want you to talk for a moment, because, you know, we talk about, you know, working in the play in the sandbox and having the tools, and with this cast, you had incredible support doing that. But on the production side, you're working with the Red Hour and with the Ben Stiller type, you know, they have a very specific kind of pedigree with the kind of films that they work with and the filmmakers they work with. And talk about the support you received from them.
I mean, there was a lot of trust with Ben and Nikki. Obviously, this is their brand. So there was a lot of trust with me. I think for me, in my POV, like, they just trusted me. I could articulate what I was going to do. And you're not going to get it past Ben and Nikki. Like, they're going to know if you're the real deal or not. So you can express what it is that you want to do and show up on the day. Nikki was there for like the almost entire production. So Nikki left me alone. He let me do it. He saw it right away. And he is there, like, you know, whatever you need, like spirit animal, soul brother, like all of it. So we're really close. And I had just a wonderful, wonderful experience working with them.
And the other thing I wanted you to talk about, because you cut the film as well, and editing comedy has its own specific challenges.
It sure does, yeah.
Talk about really that a little bit.
Well, here's the thing. Like, last night, watching it at the premiere, like, all of my, I really felt like the risks that I took with just timing, like, paid off, because everything landed. And so the sort of, like, the applause and you know, laughter and tears, they all come, and it's like a, it's almost like counter, you have to think about it, you have to design it like almost counter to where things are landing, because you're accommodating for that space. I mean, I really think, I'm not sure if it was conscious or not, I mean, it has to be, but it was designed for an audience, you know. I feel like this movie was designed for,
totally,
for an audience to watch, not to watch it on a, you know, on a small screen, like in your living room. It feels like that experience last night. The only thing I can equate it to, I'm a big grindhouse guy, and like, I love, you know, 70s, 80s, you know, exploitation stuff, horror, all of that. It felt like, you know, I was at the New Beverly or something watching.
You could hear the reaction,
like,
ratchet up as the movie,
right,
as intended, as designed. Like, the reaction got bigger and bigger. Too.
Well, that's why I wanted to mention that you go, there's one thing, we've all seen movies, been involved in movies, and we love hearing the laugh. But there's a different kind of laughter last night, and there's a different and it was the appreciation of the build that you've been talking about.
Right.
I felt like everybody was really on board.
Cathartic.
Like,
yeah,
they were on board for the ride.
They were clapping for a thing.
But what's interesting?
Four or five times, like after at the end of a scene and
applause
stuff.
Breaks,
you know? Yeah.
But
yeah. That
what's
was so
interesting
cool
is that the first 20 minutes of the movie, it's a slap in the face. It really,
uncomfortable.
It's a big ask for people to sit and accept these characters for who they are, and the payoff of the movie is really they figure out who they are together as yeah. characters, and I think that's what is really gratifying for the audience, is to be able to you at first see these characters that you think you have nothing in common with, and by the end of the movie you really can see yourself in them, and that's what's so gratifying.
Yeah. And the other thing I want to add before I wrap is that, you know, as actors, you know, you're always taught about, you know, the arc that you're building and the mm-hmm. arc that you're working on, and this may have been two of the textbook wonderful arcs for two lead characters between Kyle and Emily, but that you guys go through. It really, I mean, and Adam, you know, got to look to you for a lot of that,
yeah,
as well.
Give it
that,
up to
that you go, know, man,
it's
start
a rhythm
from,
building. You know, yeah. It is. It's a design. You know, I mean, there's the film that you write, the film that you get in the can, and the film that you edit, and they're all completely different from each other. So it's, you know, there's a lot of ways you can go, like the order of your shots, all of it, like how long they linger, you know, how quickly you cut it. So it just, I really did my due diligence, went through exhausted every possibility. I was experimenting with things that, like, I wanted to see how it played. I really took my time with the edit. Like, it was a long edit. You know, we wrapped this film in 2018. September of 2018. So it was like right in that weird zone, mm-hmm. like pre-festival anyway. So I knew it was a wash. So I was just going to have to go ahead and aim. So I had time, you know, and the producers let me do it my way. We did it really slow. And, you know, I spent 6 months in sound design too. And that, to me, that 5-1 mix is so important. You know, it's just all the elements, you know, it's front to back, first frame to last frame. You know, I was even obsessed with the end crawl credits being correct, you know, it's symmetrical. So
exactly.
You know, so everything.
Well, again, it is just a giddy freaking joy to watch. Yeah. The film is Dinner in America in the U.S. Dramatic Competition at Sundance. We've had Adam, Emily, Kyle, Pat, and Leah. It's wonderful to have you guys here.
Thank you so much.
The Festival Daily Buzz would like to thank the following businesses for their support: Ketos Brewing, Pro Bar, The Market in Park City, and The Social Study in San Francisco.
We are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. I'm your host, John Wildman, here with my Bitch Talk teammates, Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. And we're going to talk about a film that we've been talking about a lot. Mm-hmm. So we're excited about this. The film is Beast Beast from the Next Section. We have our director, Danny Madden. And we also have two of our stars from the film, Shirley Chen and Will Madden. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
All right, we always start this off with having our filmmaker introduce our audience to the film. So, Danny, tell us about Beast Beast.
How's it going? Beast Beast is a story of three young people in a southern town. It's three interwoven stories. They each kind of have their own trajectory, their own journey, and it's the way they all kind of come together through. There's new love, and there's petty crime, and there's gun violence, and it's the world we live in right now.
Well, you know, the world we live in right now does involve a lot of gun violence. And that is a central point in the film, the gun culture and its effect on high school students in particular. And I mean, there's almost a subgenre of films about that by this point. Mm. So I wanted you to start off to talk about that going into this. If you were self-aware of that going in, going, you know, other films have dealt with this, but we have this other idea. Or if, because there are other themes interwoven within that you weren't all that concerned.
I think it wasn't, we weren't leaning on this as an issue film, you know? We're making a film about human beings, and one of them happens to have this particular hobby, and we tried to treat it as objectively as possible, as if he had a, you know, passion for cooking or woodwork. You know, it's like, this happens to be his thing, and let's explore what that means, like, and how it interacts with other people.
And I know, and you know, Angela and Aaron want to jump in real quick, but before we do that, we also want to talk about the fact that this was a short mm-hmm. prior, mm-hmm. and you know, and that offers its own challenges when you're expanding a short to a feature, mm-hmm. You know, as well as, you know, obviously the inspiration for it. So briefly talk about that too.
So Will and I actually wrote the short together a few months after he moved to Los Angeles. We were like, let's put it together. It's something we've been feeling, our kind of like shared theater background, and we did an open call at a high school in Los Angeles, which is where where we found Miss Shirley Chan, who came in and just like absolutely stunned us. And we were like, hey, we made the short together. And then completing the short, like through that, we became really like tight and good collaborators and stuff. And Shirley really felt like she's after the same things creatively, artistically as Will and I. And so we kind of had the confidence to like, let's open this up. Let's show more of it. Let's round out this character and let's add a few more to the mix. And let's kind of flesh out the world.
Yeah, with that, so we'll turn to you, Shirley. I really love, you know, we've seen stories of young love, but something that was so special about your connection with Nito is, you know, it was passionate, but it was still so innocent and mm-hmm. playful. Mm-hmm. And I loved that innocence of that relationship. And of course, that speaks to Dan's direction, but also your connection with Nito. Can you talk about how you got to that place with him?
Yeah, I think the first time we met literally was like me, Danny, Jose, and Will, and we got tacos. Mm-hmm. And yes, it was the vibe was very much all the boys were doing flips and like running around. And very much like when you put Jose and Danny together, they're like wrestling. And like it's this very fun, like, you know, boy energy.
Yeah.
And so I think that Danny made sure that we were always introduced first as like friends first and like collaborators, and mm-hmm. so we did do a lot of rehearsals of some of the more intimate scenes going into filming. But I think one thing that really was effective with me and Jose is we were allowed to take the family golf cart out for a spin. So we filmed in Peachtree City, which is the unofficial official golf cart capital of America.
And what? So basically, I need in on this.
Yeah. Yeah. And so basically everyone kind of owns a golf cart, even if you don't golf. And so Danny let us take the golf cart around, and there's these beautiful like fairy tale-esque golf cart trails in the woods. And so we took it to the supermarket and we just had a blast. And yeah, so I think that's kind of how we developed our relationship.
Shirley, I want to talk about your character. Yeah. And at the first half of that film, you're very smiley. It felt a little bit like you were kind of the model Asian girl in high school. I mean, I played that role too in high school.
Yeah, yeah.
And then things happen. You're traumatized, yeah. Almost raped, and mm-hmm. Then you go there. Can you talk about going there at the end of this film and feeling your power?
Right. So without giving too much
right.
away,
yep.
I do think definitely the film starts off very close to how I kind of am in real life and how I like to interact with my friends. And of course, I grew up doing theater. And so, yeah, I think that it was very important to all of us that we approach the harder scenes very, very much from a real perspective. And I think that that is built upon, you know, establishing a very real and honest and very innocent character and just staying true to that and feeling like, how would I, as Krista, really react to these circumstances? And so for me, it really was built on this basis of this very sweet and very, like, very optimistic girl who really looks at the world. She early in the film, she says, like, things work themselves out, and that's what she believes. And so when she's faced with things that prove that maybe things don't work themselves out and good doesn't always win, I think that's kind of where I approached taking on those issues.
All right. And Will, you're being directed by your brother, and apparently this was at the end of a long series of things, projects from when you guys were kids,
yeah.
being directed by your brother
yeah.
and being his film slave, I
his,
guess.
Puppet.
That's putting it lightly.
Film slave.
Yeah. John or film bitch.
Film bitch. Exactly.
I prefer puppet or muppet. but yeah, I mean, it's not our first rodeo, man. We've been making stuff for 23 years together. I can't say that wow. half of that for anyone else in my whole life. Mm-hmm. So we have a sort of this fluidity in how we work. We speak a sort of fluent language, often kind of nonverbal when we're collaborating. And again, what Danny was saying, like how surely we kind of share an aesthetic of like we want to push it and go further and challenge ourselves and explore and just get messy and dirty and crazy. And that kind of just like wavelength, on like same radio signal. And that allows us to go to just cut down all falseness, all kind of cordiality, and just kind of be messy together. And we've been doing that for two decades. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, it's to the credit of all three of you, and that, you know, these characters could have been caricatures, and they could, you know, and in a sense, you know, they are archetypes of a sense, but, you know, there it is very nuanced, the portrayals, the performances you guys you know, deliver. And I would love for you guys to talk about which you already led us into, Will, a little bit, that process of making sure that you got a little bit detailed, you got a little bit more detailed, you know, that we just didn't stay on the surface for what the kids were going through. So Shirley, start with you on this one.
Yeah, I think a lot of the most fun moments, at least for me watching Krista in the film, is when she's very, like, she's just having fun with her friends, and I think a lot of that came from this really strong connection we had really early on with a lot of the other high schoolers, like actors playing high schoolers. And so for me, I think that those fun little details and those fun, like, oh, these weird looks and that we had came a lot from just this immediate connection, especially with Courtney Dietz, who plays Krista's best friend in the film. And she did obviously a really great job. But I also think that when editing, like, Danny does a great job of, we're able to trust him in that we can just kind of play, and then he can point out, he'll find the gems. And so I think it's about kind of feeling comfortable and natural, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, from the first time reading it to, like, the last day of shooting, I was like, this cannot be 2D or a caricature, or else the audience is just not going to be with Adam specifically. You know, we're not here to kind of say, to demonize any group of people or to have, you know, to sort of categorize anyone. And the whole point is to kind of try and get the audience to empathize with them. That's sort of the point of storytelling, I think. So, you know, we did a lot of things to try and make him, you know, for lack of a better word, just likable, just human. And if he's just human and vulnerable, you can't help but just kind of feel for him. And then if you feel for him, you might see from his perspective, and then we can start having an actual conversation and not just sort of demonizing another group of people.
Right. I think that was a really important point. Obviously, technology and social media is a huge undertone throughout this story. Can you talk a little bit about the commentary that you want to have, the conversation you want to have about our perception of people online versus how we want to be perceived?
Yeah, I think it's a little less of a commentary, more of just like, here is, I'm just going to like put the facts out. This is how people interact nowadays, and this is, I mean, we see the sort of like positive effects and the negative effects of it, you know, but it's like, for me, it's trying to be as objective in how we deal with that as we are with the characters, you know, and just be as non-judgmental and fair and say, this is how people are interacting these days. And we're not saying like, this is bad or this is great. We're just saying like, here it is. And like, what do we do with that? You know?
Mm-hmm. Mine's not a question. It's just a comment. Thank you for putting people of color in this film and prevalent.
And that wasn't like our aim. I wrote this movie for them to tell a story about American kids, and these are American kids, and that's, you know, they come in all colors. Yeah. You know?
Well, that's a good way to end it. Again, the film is Beast. In the next section at Sundance, we've had our director, Danny Madden, and two of the stars, Shirley Chen and Will Madden, with us. It's great to talk to
Thanks,
you guys.
Y'all.
Thank you so much.
We are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. I'm your host, John Wildman, and joining me on this segment is one of my teammates from Bitch Talk, Aaron Lim. And we're going to do a special roundtable segment, and I want to go around the table and have everybody introduce yourselves and tell us what organization you're from, or in the case of PJ, who's sitting next to me, throughout one of our films. All right, so let's go down the line and introduce yourself to our audience.
Hi, I'm Sapna Sakya. I'm with the Center for Asian American Media, and I'm doing talent development and special projects there.
Hi, I'm Derek Nguyen. I am a writer, director, producer. I co-founded a production company called The Population, and we have a film here premiering on Sunday at noon called I Carry You With Me, by Heidi Ewing. So, hope to see you there.
Hi, I'm PJ Raval. I am a documentary filmmaker. Most recently, I made a film called Call Her Gunda, which broadcast on PBS and POV this summer. I'm here attending as a member of ADOC, which is the Asian American Documentary Network.
I'm Paula Madison, and I'm a board member of the Center for Asian American Media. I retired some years ago as the head of diversity for NBC Universal, and I'm a filmmaker and author, and I my project has to do with finding my Chinese grandfather's descendants in China.
I'm going to kick it off. I really want to talk about representation since it's so top of mind. And this is just a conversation, so whoever wants to chime in, that'd be great. Last year was our first time at Sundance, and there are some amazing Asian spearheaded films, right? Miss Purple, we had The Farewell. And then you look at the Academy Award nominations, and a lot of nominations this year, except for Parasite. Love Parasite, giving mm-hmm. it love. But those people were missing. So what's happening? If anyone wants to...
I mean, I think we also have to think about how do films get nominated, for instance. Who is talking about the film? You know, who... We spend a lot of time thinking about who is on screen, but we also have to think a lot about who is behind the camera. But not only that, who are the critics, right? Who are the voting blocks, for instance? So for me, it was really sad that Farewell didn't get nominated, but we also have to take into consideration the Academy is still very much a white male-dominated organization. So I think that's the question that we need to really be thinking about.
Mm-hmm. You know, from all the way back from the Joy Luck Club on, it seems like every few years, the Asian American filmmaking community goes, finally, we're going to be okay. We're going to be okay. Right. And then it's on another 3 or 4 years, and it's going, finally, we're going to be okay. So are we getting even closer, even remotely closer to that point where we go, no, you know, our films are going to be made. And, you know, and not just exactly as PJ, as you're saying, not just representation on screen, but, you know, but the producers, the people giving us money, the executive producers, you know, the directors. I would love for all of you to weigh in on that.
I think it's really optimistic to say that every few years the Asian American community says, finally, we're going to be okay. I think that just go back a few years from Crazy Rich Asians. Mm-hmm. We had The Ghost in the Shell. We had The Great Wall. We had Hawaii. We had films that were offensive mm-hmm.
yes.
yeah. to yes. those of us who are of the Asian diaspora. And what I think does happen, however, is that when we saw the entire, landscape change because Hollywood finally paid attention to the impact and the influence and the reach of Asian Americans, that really came out when we saw Crazy Rich Asians. It was like, oh, okay. Having worked on the administrative side for NBC Universal for years, what I would say to you is that you do still have to look at who's greenlighting. You do still have to look at who's casting, who's promoting, and still what you'll find is we as people of the Asian diaspora are not really represented very well there. There's some, but not very well. And the fallacy of the model minority and the good to get along with Asians still kind of is in play in those institutions because a lot of them, unfortunately, are not comfortable raising a ruckus. So I think that it's really not true that every few years we say, oh, we're going to be okay. It's kind of like we feel like, oh, we got one over on them. Let's see when the next time is we're going to get screwed.
right.
But I think, I mean, we're talking here mainly about commercial film and television, perhaps. I feel like, you know, being more on the independent side, both in nonfiction and narrative, the indies have been working for years on their own projects without getting permission from anyone. So I feel like, you know, it's great that there's this exposure with a film like Crazy Rich Asians, but, you know, there have been Farewells for years. And I think they haven't really come or percolated. I think the great thing now is people are paying attention and saying, we can see those projects as well.
Yeah, I actually think that there's a new audience. I think there's a coming of age of younger Asian Americans that are from kind of like the YouTube generation that have a stronger social consciousness in some ways. Not stronger, but they are more aware of them not being on screen, that they're not being heard, you know? And so I think that now films are now tapping into those audiences, and those audiences are large, you know? And that's where I think that's where I'm optimistic, you know? I agree. It's hard. Every few years you think, okay, we're finally there. But then there's always so many things that, you know, set us back. It's like, you know, two steps forward, one step back, you know.
I think one thing that's also telling is during the Golden Globes, if I'm not mistaken, The Farewell was not nominated as an American film, right? Yeah. It was thought of as a foreign feature just because of language, for instance. So I do think that is also telling in terms of what audiences are thinking in terms of what makes a quote-unquote American film, right? And not to take it off topic, but, you know, as a filmmaker who has attended a lot of, you know, maybe panels on diversity or thinking about initiatives, usually when I go to them, I notice the filmmakers in them tend to be Black, Latinx. I rarely see any Asian Americans in some of these. And so I do think about, you know, our, you know, even in the industry, even in you know, organizations thinking about structures, are we including Asian Americans in terms of thinking about diversifying and inclusion?
And touching on that subject, on Bitch Talk, we've had the filmmaker H.P. Mendoza on, who we love, and we had a 2-hour conversation, because we had a little whiskey involved. But he brought up a great point, and it's just resonated with me the last few years after we had that interview talking about gatekeepers, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Who are the gatekeepers? Like, we were talking about the Academy, and he's like, we just need to be our own gatekeepers at this point.
Yes.
And so I feel like that's what y'all are doing, so if you want to talk about that, too.
Well, I think that now, I think that at least for the Vietnamese American community in which I come from, there was an immigrant, you know, community that came in, and it's all about survival, right? And then the next generation is who are hopefully going to colleges and becoming professionals. Right. And hopefully that's how I see where our community is coming from. I feel like I'm a part of that generation, you know, where hopefully we can, you know, become the gatekeepers, you know, and become artists, which is another thing that, you know, immigrant communities have a struggle with, you know, and I'm seeing that more of us are going into those positions, and our parents are allowing us to.
The gatekeepers concept in those areas, like, you know, I think of journalists, and I think of, like, you know, having someone like Justin Chang at the LA Times. You know, I think of publicists, you know, having amazing publicists like David Magdale or my friend David Nin at Kino Lorber. Yeah. And you go that is that gatekeeper thing that we're talking about, where you go, well, no, it's not just a simple aspect of, you know, of Scarlett Johansson being allowed to play a role, you know, or what have you. No, it's like, who gave the money for the project?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And who's casting that project? You know, who's setting, you know, PJ up for his next film? Who's putting that up? Mm-hmm. And I think that's, to me, it always goes back to the money, right?
Mm-hmm. It does go back to the money, and it also goes back to the control of the purse strings and what they consider to be a great script or great casting. And I think particularly in this generation, it has to be that it's a broader, more global look. The quest for getting Chinese money, I think, is kind of over. It's proven to have been an okey-doke. And so the reality is, instead of looking to China, maybe you look to the AAPIs who are here, who are U.S. based, and let's figure out how to cast, fund, develop, et cetera, with them.
Right. So stop chasing the Wanda Corporation.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, just to touch on what PJ was talking about foreign language films, you know, like The Farewell was considered a foreign language film. I actually feel that now, as Asian Americans, we have come to this reckoning, you know, that our experiences are very different from the experiences of people in Asia. I give a huge shout out to Parasite. I love this film. I'm working with CJ. But it's not an Asian American film, and I think that a lot of Academy members might think, "Oh, that represents Asian America," and that is a little frustrating. It's exactly what we were talking about earlier, and so for me, I'm feeling like the voice of Asian America is hopefully emerging louder in the next few years, especially in media. And in the end, we have to tell our own stories. You know, if we rely on other people to tell the stories, I'm not going to swear, no.
We can keep it out.
But,
yeah.
But it might go, yeah, no whiskey. But it will go to crap, you know, and it's inauthentic. And I think that right now, authenticity is the most important thing in storytelling. Mm. So I'm hoping that our Asian American brothers and sisters and anybody in between are telling their stories and telling them honestly and without censoring themselves, you know.
Well, this has been a wonderful catching up and something that's kind of become a tradition on the Daily Buzz, and it has been since the day of our founder, Irene Cho, you know, made this such an important part, and Lanzi has continued it. I want to thank all of you for being here, and I look forward to seeing you all next year when we do our next catch up on how things are working. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And that's a wrap on today's edition of the Festival Daily Buzz on KCPW and kcpw.org. This show is made possible with partnerships with the Slam Dance Film Festival, GoTo Productions, and KCPW Radio. In-kind donations are provided by Pro Bar, Keto's Brewing, and The Market, Park City. Our audio producer is Charlene Godo. Social media help was provided by Shoshana Howard. And assisting us in production are Chris Gardner and Brian Silverman. Our executive producer is Lancia Wan. Thanks for listening.